Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. Her name is Barbara Summer Fagan, and she wrote My American Dream, which I have already read twice. I recommend it highly. We are going to be talking about this book the whole time. So if you want to just buy it while you're listening to the interview, just go to barbarafagan.com. Fagan is F-E-I-G-I-N.com. All right, so there you go. And we'll keep talking about it. Now, Barbara is many things. She's a mother. She's a wife, I'm going to say. She's an author, and she was a pioneer in business, as well as her story, which we're not going to give the whole thing away, so you have to get the book. Welcome, Barbara. See, I was about to tell your old story already.
Thanks so much, Hillary. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. Oh, my God. So, all right. Why don't you talk about why you wrote the book rather than me trying to explain it and who it's for and all the other stuff you were saying. So go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
I will be back in a few minutes.
Okay. Well, I was a refugee with my Jewish father and my Lutheran mother from Nazi Germany in July of 1940. And I knew that we had escaped. I was 2 years old, but I knew none of the details regarding this escape at all. My parents never spoke about it. I never asked any questions because I was focused on becoming an authentic American girl, this little German-speaking refugee girl with hand-me-down clothes from the neighbors. So about 10 years ago, I was sitting in my office in New York, and my phone rang. It was my sister calling me from Annapolis, Maryland, where she lived. And we talked regularly and generally brought one another up to date about our families and so forth. But she said to me, "Barbara, I've got something amazing to tell you." I said, tell me. She said, "I have found a journal among our father," our father had died, "among our father's papers, a journal that he kept in the run-up to the escape and throughout this escape itself." Well, I was stunned. She sent me the journal, and I just felt a shock run through my body when I picked it up. It was in my father's handwriting. It was in English, which shocked me because I didn't even know he could speak that much English or he knew that much English. But the journal was amazing. It started with his and my mother's frantic rush to get the appropriate documentation and the appropriate financing and sponsorships to leave Germany. And this was very late. This was July of 1940. So it was very much at the onset of World War II. And my father was frantic, as he writes about in his book. Finally, he got passage for the three of us on a train from Berlin that went for 17 days with a group of 81 refugees, including the three of us. The train went from Berlin through Lithuania into Russia, across Siberia, into Korea, China, and Japan. 17 days on this absolutely horrific, dirty train, a terrifying trip, really. Everyone running for their lives from the Nazis. The train stopped 14 times on this trip, and each time My parents, as my father wrote, had to take out their documentation and show it, and sometimes their few little pieces of luggage, which they were able to carry, were searched, and they were terrified each time that they would be taken off the train, and God knows what would have happened to them had that happened. Finally, they came with as I said, you know, what they could carry, including me. They brought a tent because they had no idea what would become of them when they reached the United States. They had no connections, no money. They were able to bring only $10.50 for our whole family. And they had no idea. My father had no idea how we would be able to make a life for our family. But they were so, so eager to escape and to get away and to get to the land of the free. They figured one way or another they would make it work. Once we got to Yokohama, Japan, we took a Japanese ship called the Hikawa Maru across the Pacific Ocean, because at that time it was no longer possible to go across the Atlantic because of the German submarines. So we went on this 14-day crossing across the Pacific and landed in Seattle. And as I say, you know, my father in his journal says, 3/4 of the way around the world into the unknown. He had no idea what would come next. He was very fortunate that a group of Quakers and a Jewish organization helped him to find a job in a very small town in Southwest Washington, a town called Chehalis. And so we, this weird, odd little family of refugees, German-speaking refugees, went to this town where there was no one like us. Everyone, you know, it was a very homogeneous population. Families had lived there for generations, and nobody quite knew what to make of us. In any event, when I read this journal, I was just stunned. I learned so much about my parents that it had never even occurred to me to think about, so much about their character, their courage and their bravery to make this escape, their determination and perseverance. They were absolutely bound and determined that one way or another, they were going to make this work. And through it all, really horrific challenges and so forth, they always were optimistic and were resilient. You know, they faced many, many, many challenges and roadblocks along the way, but they always were looking forward and trying to figure out how to make things work. Well, Hillary, you asked me what was the impetus for writing my book. I thought, you know, I learned so much about my own life through learning about my parents and what we had gone through. I thought, gee, I never want my kids to be as ignorant of what came before them as I had been of what came before me. So I thought, one way or another, I've got to figure out how to write a book about this, because I really want my children, my grandchildren, and generations to come to really know what came before them, because that really is what makes us who we are to a large extent.
So Barbara, when you say that you didn't know the story, did you know any of it? I mean, did you know? So this picture is of Barbara when they arrived in Seattle, right? Seattle?
Yes, yes.
And I mean, did you know anything? Did you know that they had escaped Nazi Germany? Did you know?
I knew that we had escaped, but I didn't really understand what that meant. You know, I didn't know any of the details of what my father had gone through, the persecution that he'd gone through prior to the time of the escape, the frantic craziness that he had to go through to get the appropriate documentation and so forth for our family. And it was so late, it was so difficult. He was running from one place to another, trying to get visas and sponsorships and money. You could only use American money for passage. And my father had a sister who lived in New York. She didn't make very much money. She'd only been in New York for a couple of years. So she had money for his passage, but not for my mother or me. So he was really, really frantic. I knew none of this. And Hillary, just thinking about it, reflecting on it, It never occurred to me when I was growing up to ask questions. My parents didn't focus on this at all. They didn't look backwards. They didn't focus on it. And I was this weird little girl when we first came, only spoke German, spoke no English. I had no clothes, and my neighbors would give me hand-me-downs, and they never fit, so my mother would have to kind of, quote, remodel them, and they always were sort of awkward-looking. And I just wanted to be like everybody else. You know, I wanted to be like all the other kids. I wanted to be part of what went on in school and part of what went on in our small little community. So I didn't spend time asking them questions about what they'd gone through. So to answer your question, I knew we'd escaped, but I didn't really have a full understanding of what that entailed and what the details were. And I knew nothing about the trip and about how horrific and terrifying that trip was. I didn't know anything about that.
So I have a couple questions, if you don't mind. When you read it the first time and you realized what they had gone through, what did you experience?
I guess you'd probably say shock. I was overwhelmed. Yeah. I was overwhelmed. And both my parents had died some years ago. And so I was just overwhelmed. I thought, oh my God, there's so much I didn't know. Mm. And there's so much about them and their character and their experiences that I just hadn't appreciated, you know? And I was overwhelmed emotionally. That's really shocked.
I mean, when I read about them, I mean, your mom with her ethic, you know, what is it? Dream big, work hard, never quit. Like, where did obviously you can only guess, where did that come from? You know, they both had such grit. Imagine if it was only one of them. Would they have made it? I mean, going in that dust without the water and not wanting to spend their money on water. I mean,
no food, no water for several days.
Right? I mean, they were so strong.
Where did that come from? What a good question. My mother was really a force of nature. You know, as I reflect back and think about her, she went through many challenges. She had a lot of really serious health problems throughout her life, at least the part of her life that I was part of. My father was very determined, very determined. He was going to make this work for our family, as I know, you know, reflecting on his what was in the journal, and I also had some letters that he had written to his family. Mm. Where did it come from? I think that they were just, first of all, thrilled to be in the land of the free. Mm. This meant everything to them. Even though they had nothing and they had no idea how they were going to make a life, they were in the land of the free, having come from a place where they'd been persecuted, my father in particular. And go ahead.
I mean, I know that he had lost, obviously I know from the book, I don't know otherwise, but he had lost his job and then they wouldn't let him sit on the bench, or he had to sit on a special bench.
Well,
was he persecuted in other ways as well?
He couldn't work. He couldn't work. Yeah. So my mother was the breadwinner.
Do you know how long? Do you remember how long that was?
No, I don't remember anything.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the thing. I just don't remember. All I know is what I know from, you know, the few conversations that we had, which were very few and far between, because they were both really always focused on going forward, focused on the future. You know, so you're talking about the benches. My mother worked, as I said, and after I was born, my father looked after me. And the family, lived in a little apartment in Berlin, and there was a little churchyard across the street, you know, kind of a place to take me to play when I was a little tot. And Jews had to wear yellow stars, and there were yellow benches that Jews were supposed to sit on. And my father would not do that. My father would not wear the yellow star, and he refused to sit on the yellow bench. He brought a chair from his apartment to sit on. Now, thinking about this.
Balls, right?
Well, and
he could have just been shot. I mean, from what we know now.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, he believed he had to stand up for what he believed in, and he was not going to do that. You know, he had been in the military in World War I, and he'd really given of himself to Germany. So he felt Germany would always look after him and protect him. No. No. So, you know,
well, it's a good thing he got out because.
Oh, yes.
And when you think of, I know, they have to read the book. You have to read the book. But you know, each piece, like there were three different ways they might go and how he got it together and got the current. It, you know, it just was meant to be because you can't imagine if one thing went wrong, you wouldn't have made it on that
exactly.
train. So
exactly.
It just was. You can't, it just was meant to be,
well,
right?
The whole
first they were going to Italy and then that fell through, right?
Well,
and
then
the boat never
then
left.
The Atlantic Ocean was kind of yeah. closed down, so
right.
he couldn't go to Italy. Then for some weird reason, he said that at one point they were going to go through Finland. That didn't work out. Then they were to go to France and to Spain. And nothing worked out, and he's scrambling around like mad. You know, he writes in his journal about spending the night in Hamburg, trying to find appropriate documentation again. And there were bombs falling, and everybody had to spend the night in a bomb shelter. And he tells about how terrified he was. You know, I mean, the whole thing is just. It just shocked me to learn all this.
But to get like all the transfers, Berlin to Lithuania, to Russia, to China, to Korea, to Japan, and then America, and then Canada, and then America. I mean,
right.
To think of the logistics and the, like, who bought all the tickets? You know what I mean? It's just incredible that whoever was behind it made it happen for those 82 people, right? Or 81.
Exactly. 81.
It's people. Just... mind, you know, but obviously, you know, there were plenty of people who didn't get the
right.
program and
right.
did not leave, and they ended right. up not, you know, being killed. So the fact that he got it when he did, and he got a visa to America from Germany, I mean, like...
At the very last minute, I mean, think about it, July of 1940, you know, very scary.
So,
very
yeah, so, scary. You know... Thankfully, or you wouldn't be here, your children, all that, right?
Right,
so,
right.
So God bless them, wherever they are, the strength and
yes.
the
yeah.
unbelievable and the courage.
Yes.
Right? The courage to leave your home. You know, I know there's a lot of refugees now, and I don't appreciate what that means. I don't appreciate what being a refugee means. Obviously, you know, you were two, but... Everything, you're torn away from everything you know, and you're starting literally new with nothing.
Well, my parents, right.
Yeah.
As far as I was concerned, my memories start in Chehalis, Washington.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything prior to that.
Wow. That's amazing, right? That you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it must have been interesting to read the parts about you in the book, you know, through his journal, right? The little girls looking at your blonde hair and...
Having raised three sons, I thought a little bit about what it must have been like to go on this horrific, terrifying train trip with no food, no water, several days with a 2-year-old. 17 days with
right.
a 2-year-old. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
With different languages and different countries
exactly.
and different
exactly.
currencies and different.
And it was very hot. It was in the summertime.
Yeah. Oof.
You know, they went across the Gobi Desert, and they talk about that. And they went into Korea and Japan, where it was very hot and very humid. And they had nothing, you know, nothing. So it's an amazing story.
The one, I know, not to give it all away, but I think it was interesting the difference between the Japanese culture, that the Japanese got served first and got
yes,
everything
yes.
first, and the other countries where they were the guests.
Yes.
Wasn't that interesting?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, so go ahead. I'll let you continue.
Well, so, it, you know, as I said, I thought after holding this journal in my hand and reading it and trying to absorb it and internalize it, I thought, I never want my kids to be as ignorant as I had been. So the book starts with the actual journal, in my father's own words, with a little bit of broken English here and there and some crossouts and so forth. And then it goes on to talk about really three different threads of my own life. The first has to do with my growing up in a small town and really just fervently wanting to become an authentic American girl, just like everybody else. I wanted to dress like everybody else, look like everybody else, just be part of the American scene. So there's that. Then the second thread has to do with my being, as you said, kind of a pioneer in a business that was very much dominated by men, the advertising business, during an era when, the opportunities for women to build careers was virtually non-existent. And that in itself is an exciting story, an interesting story. And, you know, I was very, very often the only woman in the room. And, it's just kind of interesting to go through that. That's an era that to some extent we've gotten past, but not completely. I mean, there still are inequities, and I think, we still need to work on dealing with them. But there were massive inequities at that time. And then the third thread of my life has to do with my marriage to my husband, Jim, and our raising our three sons during a time that, as with all families, we had our turbulent moments, but the most shattering was when my husband had a very serious stroke when he was really in the prime of his life. He was only 54 years old. And so in addition to raising my kids and building my career, I was his caregiver in chief for 25 years. So those are the three threads. And you asked, what do I hope people take away from this book? I would say, there are three things. Number one, I hope there's a renewed appreciation for the importance of freedom, the importance of and the preciousness of freedom. When you read my father's journal and you feel a little bit about what it's like when you don't have it, he says, to be able to be who you want to be, to say what you want to say, to read what you want to read, to have a free press where you get a variety of opinions, and you're free to listen to them and read them. Hugely important. And I hope I can raise consciousness about that. Second thing is, I very much took away from my parents from a very early age the power of education to open doors to opportunity. Again, hugely, hugely important. And then finally, as you said when we first started talking, my mother's philosophy and mantra, which she passed along to me and which hopefully I passed along to my own kids, dream big, work hard, and never quit. And, this really involves perseverance, determination, and very importantly, optimism and resilience. It doesn't always work out the way you think it's going to the first time around or the second time around, but keep at it and, try to figure out ways around and over and through the challenges to get closer and closer to the goals and the visions that you've set out for yourself.
Wow. It's so amazing that she, if she came up with that, like, where did she get that from? It's so important,
I think my
my father was one to, average was the best of the worst or the worst of the best. You know, like it was like be your best. You know, you didn't want to be average. It was really like a standard.
Yeah.
That was just natural to us. I don't necessarily see it in the next generation. I don't know. I found it harder to pass down. Maybe my father was just a force to be reckoned with. But, you know, I don't know if it was coming from the backgrounds that they came from, that they had to. You know, it wasn't handed to them, that's for sure, right? Your parents had to fight for everything.
Oh, my goodness.
And so did you. Yes. You know, so did you. Yeah. Well, I think that's such an important thing. Yeah. Yeah. But so did you. I mean, you also fought in the male world. I mean, I don't know if you're finished, if I can ask you more questions.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So when you say you're the only woman in the room, some people might have been intimidated and not, you know, fought. Like you were very, it seems, outspoken. When you had an opinion, you didn't kowtow to these men. How did you get, like, were you just born that way? Or was that something you learned?
No. I'm
like,
I was very shy. And it was a little scary, you know, to be the only woman in the room. And, it took me a long time to find my voice, you know, and there were times I was on the boards of a couple of New York Stock Exchange companies. And I remember when I went to my first board meeting as the only woman in the room, the men obviously had no idea what to do with me. You know, I think they viewed me as sort of the token woman, you know, and they talked among themselves and laughed and joked around and so on. And I finally realized that I had to just raise my voice and raise my voice until finally they stopped and listened. And they realized that I had something to bring to the table, you know. And once that happened, then I became integrated into the group. But it certainly, I was always very shy and not particularly outspoken. It took me a long time to learn what I had to do to get there.
Well, that must have taken something to open your mouth, you know?
Big, work hard. And
yes, right? It must have come from within. It would have been a lot easier to sit there, you know, not, yeah. Now, was that the VF?
Yeah.
It was called VF?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. So, okay. All right. Well, I wanted to know, like, you were, and I know we're skipping, but, you know, you had this childhood, she believed, so she believed, well, you got to read the book, right? I'm not going to tell them. I'm going to tell them.
Read the book.
She gets far. And you saw the inequality of women, which, you know, was flabbergasting, right? I think young people would be flabbergasted to know what it was
like. But in that era, it was not flabbergasting because that was the way things were. That was the way it was. When I went to business school and, well, I'll tell you just a small little sidebar story.
I went
to a program that was run jointly by the Harvard Business School and Radcliffe Graduate School because at the time, women were not admitted to the Harvard Business School. It was a male-only school. So we, and the males were called men, and we in my program were called girls. So so we girls were not allowed to go to any of the classes at the business school. We had exactly the same classes with exactly the same professors, but it was not on the campus of the business school. It was at Radcliffe Graduate School. So, but the business school, you know, invited absolutely fabulous business leaders from around the world to come to speak. They would make speeches and then there'd be cocktail parties. And they always had a dinner party for the speaker afterwards. And they would invite one of us girls along with a handful of men from the business school. So I was invited.
How did you get on one? Like, why invite one? Or how many were there of you?
60.
So you each got... What?
I think they thought they were doing us a great favor to invite one, you know. So anyway, I was so excited. I got invited to one of these dinners. And it was at the Harvard Club in Boston. And I got all dressed up and I went marching off to the Harvard Club and up to the front door. And the doorman said, "No, no, 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 you can't come in here." And I said, "Well, I'm invited to a dinner here." "Oh, no," he said, "you can't come in here." I said, "But I'm invited to a dinner here." He said, "You have to go around the alley and through the kitchen. This is for men only." And that was kind of the way it was, you know. And I didn't get all upset and I didn't do a big rebellion. I went through the kitchen and went to dinner. And, you know, it was just like that. When I first came to New York, I wanted to work in marketing. And the jobs that were sort of the career path stepping stones in marketing were those that had profit and loss responsibility, product management and brand management. And those jobs were simply closed to women. You couldn't get a job like that if you're a woman. So I went into marketing kind of through the back door, through market research. And again, I didn't think anything of it. I thought that was fine. I'm working for a great company, the Vic Chemical Company, makers of Vic's VapoRub, Formula 44, all those good things. And I was there for a year, and I'd gotten very good feedback about my work. And I thought, you know, I think it's time for me to go and have a conversation about my career path and about compensation with my boss. So I made an appointment and nervously went in to talk with him and sat across from him. He's a very nice fellow. His name was Tom. And I said, "Tom, it's been a year. You know, I want to talk to you about career path." And he just stared at me. And then he threw back his head and he just started roaring with laughter. And I said, "Well, why are you laughing?" He said, "Career path? There is no career path." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Women." "Yes, women. They get married, they have babies, they leave." I said, "Well, Tom, I went to business school. I'm getting married, I'm going to have babies, but I went to business school, I want to have a career." "Well," he said, "Barbara, I can't help you. We don't have that here. If that's what you want, you have to leave." So I did. And I found my way into the advertising business, and that's where I spent the rest of my career, which was fabulous. I loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it.
Wow. All right. We're going to take a quick break for our sponsor. Of course, I have more questions for you, and then we're going to come back. All right. All right. Thank you. Before we go, this is just to you. Can you hear me? So BJ, cut this out. So you're not centered.
Oh.
Half of your fit. Yeah. Like when you back up, so if you can move it just a little. Yeah, that's better.
Is that better?
Yeah. Okay, good.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you were back, I could see your whole face, but otherwise part of it's cut off. So, okay. Good. Okay. All right. So BJ, cut that out. I'm going to take us off for the commercial break. Okay. Bye.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Okay, welcome back to the Getting Real with Hillary show. Thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to bring experiential social-emotional learning to your schools, to your teams, to your businesses, go to KikoriApp.com and schedule a conversation. It is really amazing, and it brings being social back, having fun back, being connected back. So I totally recommend them. And then, as always, if you're not free to speak, and we were just talking about that, Barbara and I, if you feel shy or there's things you just don't think you could say, you can't tell your children about your harrowing escape from Nazi Germany, get my book, Real Talk. It'll help you speak up, and you can always schedule time with me. You can go to, what is it, realtalkwithhillary.com, get the book, and schedule time to talk, because I'm all about saying what you're afraid to say, because I know it has created a lot of freedom for me. It wasn't easy, but I did it, and I want to create freedom for you as well. So now we're back to My American Dream with Barbara Summer Fagan. There she is. Yay. All right. Good. So we were talking about your advertising career. Oh, I know. So what I was thinking about when I read the book for the second time was, it seems like that market research, and you could tell me if I'm wrong, gave you like a certain special knowledge that made you so successful in the advertising, because you, now, I don't know if that's true, but you understood consumers. That's something that the book said. You understood consumers because you were from, you know, the West. You weren't necessarily living in New York City. You knew people, you understood them. I mean, it seems like for you to rise to that level of success and notoriety in a great way, and, you know, just being selected for all those boards, having people reach out to you, you know, you must have had something special. And I'm wondering if that market research piece gave you something special that the other people might not have had because they never were in that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So it actually benefited you to not get the job and then go into that, right? And then is that what happened, or was that,
well,
my mixing up the apples and the oranges?
I was very, very fortunate to go to Gray Advertising, which, you know, when I went to Gray, it was still sort of a smallish advertising agency on its way to becoming medium-sized, and then became what Fortune magazine called a global powerhouse. It was really a huge, highly successful agency. And they valued so much understanding the consumer. I think, before Gray began to really value consumer really knowledge and understanding, the way advertising got made was that generally it was a group of men, because as we said before, there were not very many women in the business. And the men would sit around and brainstorm about whatever their gut hunches were. And sometimes they'd get input from their wives or from their secretaries. But research, to the extent that it was done at all, was done to determine which of several alternative ads or commercials was more effective. Gray said, no, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to really work on the upfront part to figure out whom should we focus our efforts on? Who should the advertising be directed to? What should the message be? What's the competition that we have to knock off? And what's their vulnerability? What's the story that we have to tell in order to make an emotional connection with the consumer. And we became pioneers in doing consumer attitude research, large-scale consumer attitude research, at a time when nobody had ever even heard of it. You know,
how did they come up with, I mean, how did they, whose idea was that?
That you know? Was the management of the agency before wow. time, before my time. I got there early on, but, you know, this whole direction had been really conceived of, and they started along this path before I got there. I was lucky because I got in early in the game and was able to help pioneer and get the word out to everybody else about it.
So like before that, and I know you had some really cool campaigns, which we'll talk about in a second, but before that, let's say the men were deciding, they would just decide what, you know, if it was a women's product, what women wanted based on their knowledge?
Well, I don't know what they decided. They might have asked their wives, you know.
Oh, okay.
Or they might have had a sort of, quote, cute creative idea, you know. Let's have dancing raisins or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
Really, research was not part of the equation at all. It really wasn't. So, you know, Gray really was a pioneer in changing the paradigm of how advertising was developed. And I was very lucky and thrilled and delighted to come in early on in that whole change and to help make it happen.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Fabulous. So you were right, you know, in asking me your original question was becoming, sort of an authority on the American consumer, part of what I could bring to the table. The answer is absolutely yes. And I do believe that it's important to have something to bring to the table, something that helps move a business forward, that helps build a brand, that helps make a consumer connection. Those are all very critical things.
Yeah. I mean, you obviously, you know, you had gone to your college, you had gone to Radcliffe, and you were like a refugee in New York City, right? You came with nothing again.
Right. That's
without
true.
Anything, without a job, and you just kept
no
making
friends,
it
no money, no place to live, no nothing.
Yeah. Yep. And look what you did. Look what you, well, you had Jim, but so right. Now, what happened to your father's sister who was in New York? Did you ever connect with her?
Lightly.
Lightly. Okay.
Lightly.
Oh, was she the one you stayed with in the basement and
yes.
got out fast? Okay.
Yes. I took up space that her dog usually took.
Well, she was lucky to get out of Germany,
yes.
right?
Yes, absolutely.
And how, I know I'm going back, but how, well, obviously you wouldn't know, but your father being Jewish and your mother not, did you ever find out if that was an issue?
Was it an issue for them?
Yeah. I mean, obviously not.
No.
Because you would have thought, I mean, I don't know, based on my relatives were, that it would have been a big deal, but obviously it wasn't.
No.
You know?
No. They were very, very strong, complementary partners. They really were. They were really together on, you know, these life-changing issues like escape. And, you know, as I mentioned, my mother had really serious health issues that they had to come to grips with. So that was never an issue or a problem with them.
Well, you know, I was wondering how, so you had your career, mm-hmm. Jim had his career until his stroke, and you had the kids. And after his stroke, when he couldn't travel, it seemed like he so supported you. Hey, go, you know, like it wasn't
always.
Any big deal. You weren't leaving, you know, like just
always.
Go like that. That was so amazing. But then you also took care of him. You know, it was just, okay, this is what's happening. This is what we do. We make it work. And you know what? Now that you're saying about your parents, you had that role model.
They
from your father.
Absolutely.
He never thought of leaving or, hey, this is too hard. I'm out of here. Right.
No.
Family first, you said. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, wow.
Very, very strong partnerships. Both my parents and Jim and me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very it's nice to see. I would say, you know, with the importance of freedom, we need to add the importance of family.
Absolutely.
Because I think that has gotten a little lost also in certain times, you know. But you guys stuck together. That was very admirable to see. You
Well,
know,
in
it's
our,
just,
I mean, fortunately, we really, you know, we both have very busy, active business lives, and we talked about, you know, what, how are we going to do this? You know, and we really agreed that first of all, we're strong partners. We, you know, we're very complementary and shared. And we decided that our priorities were really going to be our family, our kids, and building a strong family with strong bonds and trying to achieve success in our careers. But we realized that there were a lot of other things that we would have to trade off and not do, given those priorities, because those took up all the time we had, you know. So, and then we communicated well. We talked as we went.
But
So,
it wasn't, I mean, I don't know how many decisions you had to make, but it seems like even so, you were so successful, you know, you were so sought after, you know, by all those, I wrote them someplace, but who knows where, but you know, all those boards and all the awards and, you know, people would just search you out. So that was another question. Like, how do you think that happened, that they knew of you? You know,
well,
you're a woman in a man's world. Is that why? Like, obviously you're
first of
doing great
all,
things, but yeah, how do they know you?
I really played a very, you know, growingly important role at Gray in the Gray management team, and work really to help get Gray's story out to the public and to potential clients and so forth. You know, so I spoke at various you know, meetings, and you know, my voice became heard. I became the chair of a big advertising research foundation group, which was all the research people having to do with advertising, meaning all the companies that had advertising budgets, all the agencies, all the companies that actually conducted research, and so on. So this is many thousands of people. So you know, then Gray, under my aegis, I guess, also began to do interesting studies of sort of the social environment, you know, what's happening in our society. And these studies got a lot of publicity, and I became known through that as well. And, you know, was asked to go on TV and was interviewed by the press and what have you. So, you know, sort of building blocks along the way. Didn't all happen at the beginning, you know, it was one brick after another.
Yeah, but oh, so that's right. So that's why I know I love the Peter Jenner story.
Isn't that great?
You were calming him down. Yeah, that's awesome,
He
right?
said, "How can I do this? How can I talk to all these people?" Peter Jennings, who was the number one news personality of the day at ABC, and he was speaking at a conference that I ran, and he just looked like he was going to get sick. And I said, "Peter, are you okay?" He said, "No." I said, "Peter, what's wrong?" And I thought maybe he was getting the flu or something. He said, and we were in the New York City Hilton Hotel ballroom. And for those who have not been there, it is the biggest ballroom, the biggest room for a meeting in New York City. So there were thousands of people there. And he looked out at this sea of people and he said, "Oh, I have to talk to all these people." I said, "Peter, you talk to millions of people every day." "No," he said, "I don't." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I talk to the camera." And I said, "Oh my goodness." He said, "What am I going to do? What'll I say?" So it was clear he hadn't pre prepared it. He thought it was a little nerve-wracking.
But you said he did great.
Well, it was the day after a Super Tuesday election, and he had been covering this election. And I said, Peter, just say a few words about your reporting last night on Super Tuesday. Oh, do you think that'd be okay? I said, I think it'd be terrific. I said, and then we'll have a Q&A. He said, but what if nobody asks me anything?
Isn't that funny?
Nobody asks you anything. I will kick it off. I'll start. Yeah. I'll ask you a question. Anyway, he was great. Yes, he was just great. And it was a big success.
Wow, that's so cool. So, okay. I forgot what else I was going to ask. But so Oh, I know. How did you do it all? How did you have the gray and all these boards and all these extracurricular stuff? Was that part of your position at Gray, or did you just never sleep? Yeah,
that was part of
when they would ask you to be on a board. I know you said you would go to Ed and he would say, yes, this is great.
Yeah.
So they gave you, it wasn't like you were a 9-to-5-er. This was just part of your job was, right?
It's sort of. Yeah. I mean, it was extra to my job, but it was well appreciated by my job.
Okay. So they didn't say, kind of
an important credential.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Wow. Woo. All right. So we have just a few minutes left. I know you've already said some of it, the importance of freedom, the importance of family. I added that for you, the power of education and your mother's dream big, work hard and never quit. What would you, if you could, you know, if your book could impact the world, what would you want to see in 5 years? How would you want to make, I know you've made a huge difference already, and I thank you for what you've done for women, for your family, for, you know, society, with the drunk, you know, the don't drive drunk. I mean, all of the difference you've made, but what would you want to see?
Well, we talked about the importance of education. I hope that the book has an effect in terms of actually educating people as to the whole Holocaust experience. Mm. It's so relevant today. And I think so many people here, so many people, period, especially young people, don't really know what that's all about from a personal vantage point. You know, my father's parents were murdered in the concentration camps. So, you know, I come to it with a very personal lens. And I think that can be educational, you know, to people who read the book. They can kind of take in this experience from a different vantage point. And I hope to be able to inspire people. We sort of talk about dream big, work hard, never quit. But I hope that people are inspired to kind of take that in and think about it. Because I think kind of no matter what stage of life you're in, what's happening in your life, you can dream big. And dreams can become reality. Sometimes it's not a straight line. Sometimes there are really tough obstacles to overcome. But keep in mind what your goal is and try to work toward it one step at a time. And, you know, if the first try doesn't work, try again. So I hope I can inspire people to really internalize that idea and make it part of their lives. If I can inspire one person, I'll feel like I made a difference.
Hmm. Thank you. And what's next for you?
Oh, good question. I have figured that out.
You things just come to you, right? And then you figure them out. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Barbara. You're just an inspiration. Just, you know, your courage, your willingness to speak up when you were the only woman in the room. I mean, that's just huge. So thank you for setting the example for all of us.
Oh, thanks so much, Hillary.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah. Anything left in closing that you'd like to impart?
Well, I hope that all of your listeners buy the book, enjoy the book, are inspired by the book. My website is barbarafagan.com, and you can buy it right on the website or wherever you buy your books. Enjoy. Yes.
And Fagan is F-E-I-G-I-N. It'll be in the show notes. And you know what? It's a great gift. So you can also buy it. Father's Day is coming up.
Oh, yeah.
I think if it hasn't passed already.
No.
July 4th. July 4th, it would be a great gift for. So buy them up and give them out, because it's really a wonderful story and it will inspire people. So thank you, Barbara. Thank you for who you are, for what you've done, for writing the stories that we can all learn it before, you know, these memories disappear, right?
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony, and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.